The sound worked. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. Before we start, just two very quick announcements. Number one, for those of you who need or want it, this is a CLE-eligible conference, so there's a sign-in sheet when you first walked in. And secondly, this presentation is being recorded, so if anyone wants to not be heard or recorded, or for their own reasons, just be aware that it's being recorded. Anyway, we have a terrific program for you this morning, and thank you again. NIH, as you know, is on everybody's mind anywhere in the multifamily development sector, whether you're an investor, whether you're a developer, whether you're financing, and it is very quickly evolving. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of drama, a lot of speculation, and so the program today, I think, will be give all of us some additional insights into where we are and to the extent we can predict where we're going. So with that, without any further ado, I'll turn it over to my partner, Sue Golden, who will moderate.
Good morning. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I just want to introduce our panel before we get started. Farthest to my right is Anita Lermont, who is the General Counsel of the City Department of City Planning since 2014, and prior to that she was a partner at Harris Beach, and many of us also know her from her years at ESD. In the middle is Dan Bernstein, who is in Venables Real Estate Group and specializes in property tax exemptions and other economic incentives for affordable housing. And to my immediate right is Spencer Orkus, who is the development director with L&M Development Partners. He started out as a project manager in high-rise construction and has been with L&M now for almost 10 years, doing mixed and 100% affordable projects. So we have a really good group here with hopefully all the right expertise to walk you through these new initiatives. One of the goals of, one of the goals of Mayor de Blasio's housing plan is to create 80,000 new affordable apartments at a range of income levels across all five boroughs. And not quite 2 weeks ago, the City Council approved two of his major rezoning amendments that were proposed to help reach this goal. One of the amendments introduces New York City for the first time a program to make affordable housing both mandatory and permanent, and it's referred to as Mandatory Inclusionary Housing, or MIH, which is a term you'll hear a lot today. The second amendment modifies a range of zoning regulations with the intent of lowering costs and reducing impediments to new affordable housing. These modifications, which are a separate zoning amendment, are referred to as Zoning for Quality and Affordability, or ZQA. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today as well. If you've been following the approval process, you know that as the amendments worked up through the community board process in the fall, opinions were, not surprisingly, all over the place, with predictions from residential development's going to come to a screeching halt, or there will be so much new residential development that our neighborhood will gentrify. So who can predict? The intense negotiations that resulted at the council gave us the amendments as they are today, and they include some significant changes to the original. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the amendments as enacted, so you can hear how the law is going to roll out. At the same time all of this was happening in the city, the state's 421A tax exemption program expired in January. 421A was a significant driver of affordable rental housing development, and it's possible that our representatives in Albany will bring it back in some form, but no one's really predicting how or when at this point, so it's a lot of speculation. We're all wondering about the impact of these three major changes affecting residential development in the city, so we've gathered this panel to walk you through MIH, and ZQA, and to discuss what all this means for affordable housing. I'm expecting this to be a very interactive discussion. Each of our panelists comes at this from a very different perspective. So I may toss a question to one, and someone else might just leap in with their own thoughts on it. And I hope that it will be lively and interesting. We're going to start with MIH. So I'm going to start with Anita. Can you tell us about where and when MIH will apply?
So MIH will apply whenever we map mandatory inclusionary housing in an area, which will be done in conjunction with certain rezonings that we do, where we anticipate a significant increase in residential density. Additionally, it will apply in conjunction with private applications where the City Planning Commission action results in a significant increase in residential density in connection with those private applications. And in that regard, we really are conceiving of MIH on private applications to really apply when there is something that allows something more than a de minimis amount of additional residential development to occur on the site by virtue of our action. There are certain types of actions that we take that we think definitionally just will not, you know, qualify in that regard. So, for example, you know, landmarks transfers or other things that really just transfer floor area that is already available will not be the subject of the applicability of MIH. And so in respect of the rezonings that we are looking at in terms of the neighborhoods where we will apply MIH, we previously stated that we intend to find 15 neighborhoods where we can apply MIH over the course of the next several years. And we have started on that process with the rezoning of East New York, which has gone through the ULURP process to the point of being at the City Council, and we anticipate that the Council will take action on it sometime before the end of this month. Beyond East New York, which is our first neighborhood, we have a number of others that have already been announced and out in the public review process. And those include the Jerome Avenue corridor in the Bronx, Flushing West and Long Island City in Queens, the Bay Street corridor in Staten Island, and East Harlem. And our staff is working very closely with HPD and other involved city agencies in connection with each of those other initiatives. I can't tell you when any of them will actually be approved, because the East New York effort, if it's an example, is really instructive in terms of the length of time it really takes to do what we're looking to do in these neighborhoods, because we're not simply looking to, you know, upzone the neighborhood. We're looking to develop a neighborhood plan in a holistic fashion that really addresses the infrastructure needs and other needs of the community. And the process that we're using is very interactive and involving the community. So it's quite a lengthy and involved process. So I can't tell you how long it will take, but I can certainly say that in addition to those neighborhoods I've mentioned, there will be additional neighborhoods announced this year that we will be working in.
So that answers big question number one. It's a citywide initiative, but for the most part, it applies in the neighborhoods that will be mapped, and then it will also apply to certain kinds of private rezoning. What about other kinds of actions by city planning or BSA, special permits and authorizations?
It will definitely apply to many special permits, because many special permits meet the requirement that we have articulated, that the action result in a significant increase in residential density. So it will apply in those instances. We don't have a lot of authorizations that would do that, but it's conceivable that there could be such a thing. It doesn't apply to BSA.
And do you have a sense of how that significant increase is going to be defined?
In connection, well, as I stated previously, it would be something more than a de minimis amount of additional residential floor area that is enabled by the actions. There isn't a specific percentage. Frankly, you know, we talked about whether or not having a hard and fast rule in that regard would be appropriate, but when we looked at the broad spectrum of different types of special permits that there are, we really concluded that it needed to be, to some degree, within the commission's discretion. What I would tell the public is that you will understand as we go forward what is intended. Certainly, you will see that it's actually, I say, more than a de minimis increase. It's more than that. But it depends on the action, and it depends on the size of the particular development, because 15% of additional residential floor area in a very large project may be considered very differently than 15% in a very small project. So it remains to be seen in some regard, but, you know, we have some private applications in the pipeline that we will be taking to the commission over the next several months, which I think will elucidate this issue.
Yeah, and so in terms of process, have you thought through, and you say it's within the commission's mm-hmm. discretion, but a developer will come in at the beginning of the ULURP process, and at that point there will be conversations,
yes.
So they'll understand
mm-hmm.
whether you consider it to be significant.
Yes.
So they'll go through the full process knowing that MIH applies.
Yes. They will.
Great.
You know, and I would just want to point out that, as I think most people in this room understand, is that, you know, the commission will take its action based on what it deems appropriate. The council, at the end of the day, will make the determination about how, if MIH is applicable, it will be applied to the particular, you know, application. It's ultimately within their discretion. As long as they stay within the confines of what we approved in MIH, to select whatever option they want, which we haven't gotten to yet, but exactly the way in which MIH will apply in private applications.
Thank you. Okay, Daniel.
Right.
Daniel's going to walk us through the affordability options under MIH.
Right, and these are the final options that were agreed upon at the City Council level, not the same as what was initially proposed, but it's where it's ended up. So there are four options, and it remains to be seen in each particular rezoned area, MIH area, which of these will be on the menu, which will be ultimately available in each area. But these are the four that will be chosen among. Option one has 25% of the residential floor area at 60% of area median income. And essentially, when I say residential floor area, it will roughly, it will track the number of units for a variety of reasons. There'll be no more than three income bands. At least 10% of the units must be at 40% of area median income, and no income band can be greater than 130% of AMI. And we'll have a slide coming up that'll show you what this means in terms of rents a little bit later. The rents under MIH are permanently affordable, and at 30%, with no more than 30% of the area median income of a family adjusted for the household size, going towards their rent, give or take utility allowance, whether the tenant pays it or the landlord pays it. Option two has 30% at 80% of area median income, no more than three income bands, and again, no income band higher than 130% of AMI, so somewhat higher income. The deep affordability band, which was added by the City Council at their request and with negotiations with the city, has 20% of the units in floor area at 40% of AMI, no more than three income bands, no income band, again, greater than 130% of AMI, and no public funding allowed unless HPD determines that that public funding is necessary to support a significant amount of affordable housing in addition to that 20%. So that's going to need some unpacking, and we'll get into that. But the first two options do allow public funding. And then there's the workforce option, the fourth option, which has 30% of the floor, residential floor area in units at an average of 115% of AMI, no more than four income bands, at least 5% must be at 70% of AMI, at least 5% at 90, no income band may be higher than 135% of AMI of those 30% of the units. It does not allow for any public funding, and it's not available in the Manhattan core, which means community districts 1 through 8, and is scheduled to expire within 10 years of the effective date of MIH unless it's extended. And the effective date of MIH was the date of adoption, March 22nd. So that, you know, we'll have to get into a discussion of what where this might be available, but this certainly won't be available everywhere as it's the most generous of the four options in certain respects.
So before we get into a discussion about HPD, I'll just click to the AMI slide so you can see it. Both of these slides are available in your materials to take home, so you don't have to worry about taking notes. There's a lot to take in. I guess the first question, it looks like HPD is going to have a pretty significant role in the implementation and enforcement of MIH, which is logical. So instead of just applying to Department of Buildings for a building permit, there will be a role. And I guess question one is, will every project that's subject to MIH have to go through HPD, and what does that mean?
The answer is yes. Every project will have to go through HPD. But HPD is working on. Sorry.
Maybe this fell. Let me try to move it up.
HPD will promulgate a set of rules with respect to MIH, and in that process, they will have an application that is a really short form. Application. They're looking to have a sort of short form regulatory agreement in light of the fact that this is a mandatory program and will apply to many more types of developments and a wide spectrum of sophistication among developers. They realized that they needed to sort of streamline, and so they will have a set of material to relate to MIH projects that will be different distinctly from what you may be used to in the inclusionary housing program. Simpler. So that will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Okay. Mm-hmm. And in the interim, while we're waiting for the rules, you said there were already some private rezoning applications, and how are things going to be handled before the rules actually go into effect?
Well, for one thing, I would say that there is significant pressure to get some of the rules promulgated quickly, and I'm not sure whether or not there may be a bifurcation of some of the rules so that we proceed on some fronts quicker than we might on others. One area that really desperately needs the rules as quickly as possible is what the in-lieu fees will be for the projects that are MIH applies, but you don't actually have to build, and you have to pay a fee to the city instead of building units. The development community is keenly interested in what those fees will be, and that will need to be addressed very quickly. At the moment, I would say that any private development that is proceeding pursuant to a city planning application is really one that would not fall into that category because of the degree of uncertainty. So there are projects that would just be, developing units. And, of course, HPD will work with people as necessary to identify issues. And we're trying to make there be very few things that would be unclear to people as they go forward. So
And at least you've got a couple of projects to use as guinea pigs.
Yes.
So Daniel mentioned that HPD would be making the determination under the VEEP affordability option for whether there's a need for public funding to support a significant amount of affordable housing mm-hmm. in addition to the 20%. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts yet from HPD on what significant amount means in that context?
Well, they certainly haven't enunciated anything publicly. There may be something in the rules on this, so I'm not sure, but I could say that certainly, you know, 50% projects, which are not an uncommon model, would clearly meet that requirement. It would have to be some significant amount above the 20%. So, you know, 50% is certainly a yardstick that I think people could use.
Yeah, my sense is that they're going to want to see projects in their term sheets,
right?
In order to get out of this. I mean, if you guys have been watching the various developments that have gone, that are going through various rezonings along the East River, what's that? If you've seen some of the projects going through ULURP along the East River, the new administration has clearly taken a position that the inclusionary programs are intended to use the market rate housing to cross-subsidize the low-income portion, and that I think the idea that you can go use subsidies to build an off-site inclusionary project or build off-site low income that will then benefit a market rate project, those days are gone. So I think with even, you know, maybe you get away with a 50-30-20 through HDC, but otherwise I think they're going to, whether you do on-site or off-site, they're going to be looking for you to, if you're doing off-site, for you to write a check to fund the low-income housing.
The new world. Okay, the debate last year over the state 421A program had a lot to do with wages that were paid to construction workers and to the permanent staff on affordable housing projects. Anita, are there any wage or hiring requirements under MIH or anything contemplated?
There are no wage or hiring requirements under MIH. You know, through the public review process for MIH, there was significant pressure put on the administration to incorporate those requirements in the zoning. And, you know, we stated that we believe very firmly that there really isn't a land use basis for those requirements, and so they don't really belong in the zoning. The city has committed, however, to study ways in which it might have wage and hiring requirements apply to housing development in some context, and I would say that would be other than through rezoning. And that effort will go on this year. So it's possible that there might be some local laws or other things related to this that one would see.
Mm-hmm. Something to keep an eye out for. Mm-hmm. Spencer mentioned the off-site option, so I think we'll just ask Daniel to walk us through that.
Sure. Can you hear me? Is that better? MIH does allow for the construction of affordable housing off-site where there's a market, for example, project that's located in an MIH area or is otherwise subject to MIH. The affordable housing can be produced anywhere within that community district or half a mile, subject to certain limited exceptions, and the difference between providing the affordable housing under MIH in the same development and offsite is that there's an additional 5% of affordable housing that has to be provided when the affordable housing is not in the same zoning lot. when it's off-site in that way. If it were in the same zoning lot, I believe that it wouldn't apply. But you have to produce more affordable housing or have someone do it on the market rate developer's behalf to qualify a project that is not in the same, a market rate project that's not in the same zoning lot as the affordable housing that's being generated. So that differs. There are significant differences between the voluntary inclusionary housing program and how this works. With the voluntary inclusionary housing program, the bonus that's received, for example, in an R10 district, a market rate project that could build a 10 FAR project as of right, if there's an affordable housing project built off-site but in the same community district within half a mile, that could generate up to a 3.5-foot bonus for each foot of low-income housing. It's a very favorable ratio for developers of affordable housing for the sale of voluntary inclusionary air rights. In this situation, we'd have to look at a particular rezoning to determine what the upzoning would be and to determine what the difference might be of a 5% increase in the affordable housing being provided, but it may not be as favorable. In most cases in the as-of-right inclusionary housing program, no more than 20% of the housing of the residential floor area would have to be affordable to hit the maximum FAR in an inclusionary housing designated area to go from a certain number up and get a 33% bonus. You would not typically need to provide more than 20% of the floor area in a building, or sometimes even less, certainly even less than an R10 building or an R10 district. Here you might have to produce 25% if it's off-site. So we don't have the exact numbers. It depends on the particular rezoning, but it's a different calculation. And the question is whether it is worth it to the market rate developer in that case to build on-site and be allowed to develop a residential project. And remember, because this is mandatory in a mandatory inclusionary housing area, absent one of the exceptions or a hardship waiver, the only way a developer could develop a residential project in an MIH area is to either build the low-income housing, the affordable housing, in their building or in the zoning lot, or have off-site development happen. So the off-site is disfavored in that way, but it is still an option to consider.
So providing some flexibility, but really incentivizing mixed-use projects.
Yes.
So Spencer, I don't know, what's the developer going to take into consideration? What would make off-site versus on-site more attractive?
Well, I think the off-site seems to really play into condo development. And it also, a lot of this depends, too, on how future tax abatements shake out. Traditionally, the 20% at 60 meshed nicely with the tax-exempt bond financing requirements and the 421A requirements and created a template for the majority of market rate rentals that were happening in the city. Off-site inclusionary was successful with condos because if you try to actually underwrite a home ownership unit at 60% of AMI, they can't even, typically the buyer can't even support the common charges. So, and the poor door concept got a bad rap purely because there was a legal need to separate, to provide that 20% at 60 as a rental where it was feasible, and the intermixing of home ownership and rentals was not particularly practical. So I think most of us are going to look at that off-site inclusionary as a method of meeting the affordability requirements when trying to do condos.
Just one add-on to that was that the 421A program previously provided that you could have a zoning lot where there were two buildings, a market rate building and an affordable building, where the affordable building would provide that 20% in the same zoning lot, and qualify both buildings for a tax exemption under 421A. And now, it, because the 421A has expired and we're waiting to see what as-of-right program may come, whether it will track that again, we would need to see it. But there was never, with the truly off-site development, there was never a benefit to that condo project that would be getting the voluntary inclusionary area. There wasn't a property tax benefit. It was just a zoning bonus, right? So there's some question. I think there's every expectation that would continue. If you're building in a different zoning lot, there wouldn't be a property tax benefit for the market rate building. There would be a permission to build under MIH.
Right. If you're doing you could do a low income rental on the same zoning lot, but in a separate building,
right,
to create a condos.
Great.
Right.
Okay, Daniel, you mentioned that there are some exceptions to the MIH requirements, so I think you may have a slide for this.
Sure, and just to run through these are generally available for smaller projects. If there are 10 units or fewer and 12,500 or fewer square feet of residential floor area, there are no MIH affordability requirements. If there are if there's a creation of 11 to 25 units and 25,000 or fewer square feet of residential floor area, the developer who's subject to the MIH requirement can make a payment in lieu of actually building low-income housing. This gets to the guidelines that HPD will have to produce to indicate exactly what price will be involved for that payment, for that calculation. So certainly developers in this of this size are thinking about that issue. And a third exception is if a project contains 100% affordable independent residences for seniors. There is, as part of the MIH text and as part of the ZQA, there's a significant series of accommodations to affordable senior housing being built in the city, and this is one of those ways. And there's also an avenue for a waiver or a modification of these MIH requirements through an application to the Board of Standards and Appeals. For that, I'll defer to Anita to take us through that.
So, you know, in order to withstand any legal challenges that we might get based on enacting MIH, we knew that we had to have a program that assured the feasibility of development broadly in the city. And in that context, we also needed to ensure that there was a release mechanism where the applicability of the MIH requirements made the economics of development infeasible. So we incorporated into MIH a Board of Standard and Appeals waiver, hardship waiver, where a developer could go and make the case that the MIH requirements specifically made their development unfeasible, and BSA could grant a waiver to the extent that it deemed necessary. Now, because this is really looking at the economics of development through the lens of MIH, which is slightly different than BSA's general, review of applications, it was felt to be very important to have HPD involved in all of those discussions. So any application that BSA receives will be provided to HPD, who will consult on the extent to which relief needs to be granted in the context of the particular application. And the idea is that the way BSA will proceed is to first look at whether or not there is another option, another MIH option that wasn't applied in the context of the particular project that is the subject of the application, and whether or not another option would make the project economically feasible. So they will go through the set of options that Daniel just talked about, and if none of those work, in consultation with HPD, DSA will be able to determine some smaller percentage of affordable housing that will be mandated in connection with a project, all the way down to being able to completely waive MIH, but it will always be done in consultation with HPD, who really would be the experts here. So, you know, I guess people have asked the question of whether or not one would need to establish that you couldn't do a project with a HPD term sheet if one were available, and I would say the answer to that is yes, you would need to be able to show that. But that's generally how that process will work. And the hardship waiver will be for a period of, I think, 4 years, within which, you know, you will have to commence and pursue the development of your project. You're not going to be able to sort of like bank a BSA waiver so that you can wait till another economic cycle, because that's really not what the purpose of this is. So you'll need to pursue your project, or else you'll have to go back to BSA again and make a case anew.
Is it possible that a project that appears to be economically feasible at the beginning, but then, say, 10 years in, it turns out that it's kind of economically shaky, can then go to BSA and say, we need the waiver now, or is it all upfront?
No, it's possible that, you know, economic conditions could change such that one might need to seek some further relief. However, it's a little hard for me to see how that actually works. In concept, that's true. But, you know, you're going to have a certain amount of, you know, permanently affordable units. You're probably going to be subject to some tax program. So there are going to be things that are going to be very constraining in terms of, you know, your actions going forward. But, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so in that vein, why don't we talk a little bit more about the economics of MIH development in the absence of 421A. Daniel, you want to get this discussion started?
Sure. This is a real challenge because mandatory inclusionary housing is designed to establish permanently affordable units throughout the city in a range of 20 to 30% on-site, and was designed to have the 421A property tax exemption in place. 421A, for those who are not familiar, essentially froze the taxable assessed value at the pre-construction level for a period of time. Typically, for a project that would contain on-site affordable, it would be 20 to 25 years, phasing out at the end. And under the revised 421A program that would have taken effect in this year, had it not been for some disagreements as to the wage issues, it would have been actually a 35-year property tax exemption. So without 421A, developers can expect to pay in the neighborhood of 25 to 30% of their residential rents as property taxes, while also making, in MIH areas, while also making units permanently affordable at somewhere 20 to 30% of the units. The issue is what projects can go forward now, what can be done to help projects go forward. So for starters, the East New York rezoning is contemplated that the developments that are in it will be 100% affordable and will receive significant subsidy from HPD to do so. So that's beyond the HPD, the mandatory inclusionary requirements. The idea is that the city intends to fully incentivize those projects that will be subject to MIH in East New York for some lengthy period of time to allow those to go forward. The other neighborhoods that may have perhaps stronger demand for residential units and perhaps a higher rent level may fall into one of the mixed income financing programs such as the Mix and Match or Mix Match 2, something where there might be a band of low-income housing, a band of moderate-income housing, a band of middle-income housing, and a property tax exemption that might be something like the 420C property tax exemption or the Article 11 tax exemption, where there has to be some ownership by an HDFC in the structure. So this is not something that most market rate developers are familiar with. It's something you are familiar with, you know, in certain regards, that some of these mixed income projects may be able to get financing and certain property tax exemptions, but market rate projects that are counting on 70 to 80% of the units being at market rate, the property tax exemption for 421A, it's not there right now, but it's also expected that there needs to be an as of right program as these changes roll out. So I think there's going to be some need to address this on the legislative level in Albany. I think the people I've spoken with from the governor's office and from the various chambers in Albany have all been making the right statements about the need for affordable housing, the need for financing. It's really a question of timing and whether an as-of-right program that might extend 421A or replace it would bring different requirements than was expected before, would bring labor costs. That's one of the questions. So I think the low-income projects will be proceeding, and a certain amount of mixed-income projects will be able to receive financing and certain other tax exemptions. There is a discretionary exemption called Article 11. There is an exemption for projects that receive low-income tax credits called 420C. And there may also be, for conversion projects from non-residential to residential that receive some substantial governmental assistance, there may be the J51 exemption and abatement. That is still an as-of-right program that's available. For new construction projects that are intending to truly have a predominantly market rate set of units, that's going to require a little more time to see what comes down from Albany on that issue. But there are certain of these projects that the city intends to subsidize, the state intends to subsidize, and that there are some of these programs available now. And also, there were such a large number of construction starts last year, not all of which will be built by the original builders, that these are going to, some of these are already, I understand, being shopped, and so it's a question of who will build them and when, because there's such capacity built into the pipeline, essentially. The question now is what new housing will go into the pipeline going forward.
Right, and there's basically three types of projects happening right now. There's condo projects for high net worth individuals that don't seem to care about real estate taxes.
Right.
There's all the market rate pipeline that got in before December. And then there's the low and middle income projects that, you know, low income projects under a 420C, which has to be 70% of the units have to be 60% or less. And all of them under 165, I think.
Yes.
And then Article 11s, which need to be two-thirds below 120, 165.
Well, 165, but they're also, for subsidy reasons, it ends up going lower. And Article 11 is at the discretion of the city council.
Which is, yeah, I mean, having...
So it's not automatic.
Making sure that you have your council person's blessing is key to the success of those projects. And pretty much every middle-income project going through HDC or HPD right now is utilizing Article 11. So then once all the rest of that burns off, I mean, you can't seem to underwrite a market-rate rental with taxes at 20 to 35% of AMI unless construction costs or land costs drop precipitously or rents go up. And in the absence of 421A, the hope is we'll see a little bit of pressure on both of those. The slowdown in supply eventually will increase market rents. The lack of work will hopefully bring construction costs back down from the stratosphere. And I doubt landowners are going to let go of their properties at a loss. But assuming that construction costs get a little bit better, that the construction is going to have the same pressure on the electeds, though, I think, to get a 421A deal in place. The expectation is that there will be something in the next 12 months or so. Certainly, as if construction jobs start becoming fewer and fewer, there'll be, I think, plenty of pressure for a deal to be made. And that should be in timing with some of these ULURPs that are going through in sort of more stronger markets.
I would just add that, you know, when we constructed MIH, we really based it on a economic feasibility analysis that was fully aligned with 421A as it previously was, and actually as it was enacted to be applicable this year, but is not. So, you know, we acknowledge at the city that the lack of 421A will have a significant effect on the development of housing units if it is not addressed, and it's our view that it's so important that we believe that the legislature and the governor will address it this year, because ultimately, in the absence of it, really, you know, market rate development for other than the very wealthy would really come to a halt as the market took time to sort of realign, which it could over a number of years, but that would be certainly, I would say, at least one full economic cycle, and you know, we really know that we need to have units developed and are hopeful that this issue will be addressed.
And I'm hopeful too that you know, that some of the proposals for changes in the 421A last year were very much in line with the changes in the mandatory inclusionary housing program that would allow for a greater percentage of middle-income units to satisfy the 421A requirements. I personally was happy to see that, because it takes the pressure off of using volume cap for 80-20s and the like. And I think there's a lot of neighborhoods, you know, particularly the South Bronx right now, that could benefit from being able to do there's a limitation on volume cap. The financing costs associated with using bonds start to just barely equal out with the tax credit benefits you get with them. And in a market like this, where you can get conventional financing at very favorable rates, to be able to go in and do, say, 30% at 80 and the rest market rate, I think would be a great opportunity.
Right. And I think just to add that the 421A legislation that was passed last June that would have taken effect this year really was something of a compromise between the real estate development community and the construction trades and the city. The issue of construction wages ended up being interjected in this process, and it is at present, to my understanding, what is stymieing this being resolved. There are conversations periodically, I understand, between the various parties, but there is a lot of product in the pipeline, as was discussed, that a lot of projects commenced construction in 2015. As that pipeline proceeds and starts to empty out, there will be pressure on both sides to resolve this issue, and on the various legislators to address it as well. So I think they may be feeling differently in, you know, some months' time. I think there's already discussions that are happening, but we need to let them bear fruit.
Right.
So there's risk, obviously, as you've heard, although if you look at it purely from an MIH perspective, there's a little bit of time because so far there's only one neighborhood in the pipeline, and the city has a plan, the 100% affordability plan for East New York, and it will take some time to get some number of years as the additional neighborhood studies are completed and zoning amendments worked out, and then they have to work their way through the ULA process. So,
MIH will still be applicable to private
residents. Yes, they will. Yes, absolutely.
Right, so.
Before we move on to questions from the audience about MIH, I wanted to spend a few minutes on ZQA, Zoning for Quality and Affordability, which made changes throughout the zoning resolution from amendments to the defined terms to amendments affecting building envelopes and parking requirements. We've included the city's fact sheet in your materials as an overview, and I just want to say that to really understand the impact of ZQA, you really need to do a site-specific analysis because it's very extensive, the number of changes that were made. But I am going to ask Anita to attempt to give us a brief introduction.
Okay. So, you know, ZQA was a proposal that we thought really needed to go hand-in-hand with mandatory inclusionary housing because we thought that we needed to address some issues that really limited or stymied realizing the affordability that we were requiring. And we also just, you know, through the years have identified things in the zoning text that really don't make for quality buildings or quality sort of street experience that we thought we would take this opportunity to address. I would point out that this type of very broad-based citywide text is really very rarely done because it is unbelievably difficult to get through the public process. Because to get through the public process, you have to have the proposal considered by the 51 community boards in the city, and they all have very different neighborhoods, which leads to sort of different concerns about what's important. So coming to agreement on a program that addressed as many issues as ZQA does was phenomenally challenging and fairly exhausting for us, so you won't see anything like this again soon, so don't worry. But ZQA really was intended to address sort of two broad issues. One was affordability, as I said, and quality. And on the affordability side, we wanted to make it easier to provide a range of senior housing and senior care facilities in the city because we recognize the changing demographics of the city and the fact that we actually, being one of the world-class cities, have a fairly anachronistic set of permissions in terms of providing senior housing in neighborhoods where people live, because we know that that's what people want. We also wanted to enable the inclusionary housing buildings that we are requiring to actually be able to fit the floor area that we allow them, because there are a lot of requirements currently that don't allow you to build your full FAR. We also wanted to try to reduce the cost of providing affordable housing in transit-accessible areas and really make parking in those facilities optional as opposed to required, because we have observed over the years that much of the required parking for affordable housing developments in the transit zone is really unutilized, and the cost of providing that parking, we believe, could be better utilized to provide the affordable housing. In terms of quality, we thought that it was important for us to try to allow better articulation and visual variety for buildings that are built. Many of the zoning requirements that we had heretofore led to very sort of street wall buildings with no articulation, and we had gotten away from what planners view as sort of a better framework, which are buildings that have the ability to articulate, to set back from the street. And we also thought that it was extremely important to allow for better ground floors, both for purposes of retail and also to ensure that people didn't build, when you build first ground floor residential, that they would have an ability to sort of step it up so that people's windows weren't at street level. We provided additional limited height for taller ground floors. We provided 5 feet for that, as long as you provided that on your ground floor. We provided limited additional height for affordable senior housing and inclusionary housing buildings in virtually every district in the city. We provided setbacks from the street to allow for that articulation and variety that I've talked about. And we provided a broad spectrum of affordable senior housing and care facilities, and we provided additional floor area for those facilities, and we provided for the use of yards to accommodate some of the common facilities in those developments. So that's broadly what we did, and I really won't go into the detail, and Sue is absolutely right that you need to look at your particular development, because through the process, a lot of the changes were made very specific to different zoning districts. So you're going to have to look, and whether you're on a wide street or a narrow street, so it's very particular, but you'll have to look.
Thank you. Spencer, all these changes, height, setback, flexibility, do you think that's going to have a great benefit for developers?
Yeah, I mean, the most affordable housing is built block and plank, and we utilize the quality housing rules to maximize floor area, and it's most in sync with block and plank construction. So the number one issue is parking. We spend so much money creating parking that nobody utilizes. It's a lot of subsidy that could be utilized better elsewhere. So I think that was the number one change that I was really aiming for. Unfortunately, the parking limitation only goes up to 80% of AMI, so it creates an issue for middle-income projects in the long run. But I think it's a great win for low-income housing. And the setback, or the retail issue, is also, I think, something that was really important to NYSAFA and all its members. We really wanted, when you get into these situations where you're doing 10 feet per floor or 9 foot floor, and you end up with these very low spaces on the ground floor that nobody wants to rent. So, we believe strongly in being a community builder, and prefer to place, even if they don't underwrite so well, different community uses on the ground floor, just to create a better quality of life and a better neighborhood. So I think this will be very helpful on that front.
Terrific. And in the materials there, the fact sheet includes a handy map on the parking that you may find useful. Well, thanks. I think unless anybody has anything to add at this point, we can open up the floor to questions from the audience. Does anybody have any questions?
I just wanted to clarify one thing. The private applications.
The private applications and whether the mandatory zoning will be required for those. The Planning Commission's response on that is not binding. Did I understand that correctly? So when you're looking at submitting an application, you're not going to know until the City Council whether it's subject to the rules?
Well, let me say a couple things about that. The Planning Commission's action will basically set the framework for what will be required. However, what I was trying to say is that the particular option that may be applicable to a private application can be modified at the City Council, because any of the options that are set forth in mandatory inclusionary housing text are available to the council. In other words, we call it something, whether or not it's in scope, and they're all in scope. So the council could choose to require a different option than the one that the commission has established. So if you have a private application, we are saying that you can come to city planning with a proposed or recommended option that you think should be applicable to your development. And we will talk to you about whether or not we think that's appropriate, but at the end of the day, it will really be the council's decision as to which option will be applicable. So we always tell people in the context of any private application, MIH or otherwise, that really you should be talking to the council from the very beginning so that you understand what the sort of parameters that they'd be asking for are.
So that's of the four options.
Yes.
But the question of whether this will apply at all to that particular application.
That's going to be a much more sort of black and white issue about whether or not there are significant increases in residential floor area present in the action. And if there are, it will be applied. That's not
okay. So you'll know at that stage whether
yes.
you're in or not.
Yes.
You just won't know which of the programs.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Great.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
EQA didn't change anything for narrow buildings.
ZQA didn't change anything for narrow buildings with regards to height limits for IH areas or non-IH areas?
No. We city planning had a proposal to make changes, but it got eliminated at the city council. So, no.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
This is for Anita. You mentioned that of the 50, your guys are looking to rezone 15 neighborhoods throughout the city, and that six have been released and are on the front of the packet. You mentioned that potentially more could be coming this year.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about as much as you can the time frame for releasing the rest of the nine potential neighborhoods that would be rezoned, and would that be in 2016 or later?
Well, some of the nine will be released within 2016. Some of them won't. Some of them will go beyond. Some of it is a question of, you know, resources at city planning in terms of staff, because these are very labor intensive. A large part also is getting sufficient political buy-in with respect to a particular area being a rezoning area. So between those two things, it really, I can't even tell you when it will be, but I'm sure that there will be more neighborhoods announced this year.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Mark Alexander, Alexander Development. I have actually two related questions. I'll start with one having to do with new regulations and streamlining regulations. One of the biggest challenges in affordable housing, in addition to the overall burden and nuance of applications and HPD processes and so forth, is the marketing process. Marketing typically takes months and months, and each applicant is subject to HPD review typically. For small to medium-sized developers, this is a really brave new world, and I would think that many would try to avoid it unless there is a very, very significantly streamlined process. What, if any, discussions have you guys had with HPD specifically regarding streamlining and making more transparent the marketing process?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that there's been a lot of discussions on this particular issue. HPD is very mindful of the fact that, you know, the MIH world is going to bring into it a number of smaller developers, and that the processes that heretofore have worked will really not work. They won't work for them, frankly, just from a volume perspective. So HPD is committed to actually streamlining this process and has a team of people that is working on making the marketing process streamlined and work more smoothly and faster for everyone. They have not promulgated their rules for that, but if you were to speak to them, they would be able to share with you some of the efforts that they've begun to undertake in that regard.
All right. We do consult in this area. That's part of the question. The second piece of the question is, look, MAH, I think there's ZQA, and I'm on a couple of boards that did some significant work behind the scenes contributing to ZQA, including the Zoning Committee of Assistance Housing and Planning Council, where a lot of the ideas came from in ZQA. But MIH really, it's a big tax increase for the real estate industry. That really is what it is. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that people try to avoid taxes, just like parking. You know, the gentleman from L&M, you know, in many areas of the city, parking is effectively a tax on development because it isn't cost effective to build on your own. And so folks try to avoid it. People divide lots and build smaller buildings to avoid having a parking requirement. To what degree have you folks thought about the likelihood that small to medium-sized developers that don't know affordable, aren't necessarily interested in learning about affordable, to what degree have you guys thought through the notion that a lot of guys are gonna figure out ways to avoid MIH by cutting tax lots in size and building 24-unit buildings wherever they can, that sort of thing, to avoid having to actually do on-site or any affordable housing on the project?
So there are a few aspects that I can highlight to address that issue. Yes, we have thought about that. You know, we have within MIH something that says that, you know, you can't subdivide your tax lot to get out of MIH. So once MIH is mapped in your area, if you have a tax lot, that's your tax lot. And if you subdivide, it's still MIH is applicable to your site. Additionally, you know, one of the reasons that we have the unit requirement accompanied by the square footage requirement is to try to avoid the issue where people build large units to get out of having to, build within MIH. So we've thought about the issue. I guarantee you that we haven't thought about all the ways that people will figure out to avoid it because this is just the nature of the game. But we're endeavoring to ensure that it's less likely.
I mean, I think you also have to just, I mean, the things you're giving up in order to avoid it. I mean, you do get the extra square footage, assuming there's a 421 program. You're going to need to do affordable anyways, and, you know, building two cores and two sets of stairs and two building systems. I think all of that at the end of the day going, you know, while the marketing process, you know, it's had some improvements and it's had some challenges that have come out of their new program, but I think the overall all the extras you get out of the program will probably exceed the pain associated with marketing. What we've really run into is that with the computerized system, you just have people blanket applying to every house, every project, sorry. And so just dealing with the sheer, well, helpful that you don't have to do the data entry anymore. The sheer volume becomes pretty burdensome. So hopefully HPD will understand when we want to underwrite higher marketing costs. And
I think just there was talk in the MIH about pre-approving administering agents, probably who have the capacity to handle the necessary marketing. There are also aspects in which the MIH process is supposed to mirror the inclusionary housing process of applying, getting a regulatory agreement, then getting a permit notice based on that regulatory agreement, but in a faster format,
absolutely,
in a more expedited
absolutely
format,
mm-hmm,
so that there's less bureaucracy, there are
mm-hmm
less hurdles to help developers, particularly those who are new to this process. I think that was specifically built in.
Yes, it is. I mean, HPD is mindful of the fact that there are a number of, making this mandatory will bring in a number of parties who heretofore would just have not chosen to be part of this process, and that they will be, you know, streamlining. I would suggest that over the course of the next several months, you will see some of HPD's proposed rules in this regard, and so you can make a better assessment of how well they are achieving the goal of making this easier for everybody.
I just have one question. My name is Pam Samuels. I work as a developer in the city. When you talk about BSA, the question is just what overreach may occur with landmarks? Because often there's landmarks and BSA permits in conjunction.
I'm not sure I understand your question in terms of overreach by the landmark.
Okay, perhaps overreach is the wrong word. But when there's mechanisms for triggering FAR transfers, you're automatically on a different lot. And you're talking about definitions where you're not the same tax laws, automatically increasing affordability. Would that then become a de facto because you're using air rights from some other...
No, sorry, no. And I thought I said it earlier. If I didn't, I meant to, that... You know, landmark transfers are not going to be subject to MIH because the way we look at that is you're just moving floor area around. Our action hasn't really increased floor area. It's just moved it from one lot to another.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Great. Well, I want to thank our panelists. You guys have... really been incredibly helpful today. And thank you all for coming out this morning in the snow, rain.
Whatever it is.